Hi, this is Peter Santoscano. Before we begin our show, I want to wish you a Happy New Year. And I want to thank you. Thank you for your commitment to seek climate solutions. We know climate work, it's not for the faint of heart, especially in a world that's not yet fully on board for the changes we need to make. It's the kind of work where we don't always see our impact immediately. So thank you for your determination and all your hard work. And thank you for listening to our show, Citizens Climate Radio. For over 5 years, we've been producing a show that we hope encourages you, educates you, and inspires you. We welcome your suggestions for show ideas, and we would love to share any good news you have with our listeners. Happy 2022, and enjoy the show. In this show, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 68 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Friday, January 28, 2022. Krista Heiser is back with another installment of the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club. This time, she looks at a book that hits very close to home. She dives into a pandemic and climate change-themed novel by Emily St. John Mandel, Stations 11. And as always, we have a good news report for you. But first, we speak to a writer and a lover of literature who found her way dab-smack into the middle of the work she loves. She's a communications director for a major climate organization. Deciding what one wants to do and be in life has often been hard for young people in high school and college. Now, with a global pandemic and a time of climate change, it's more difficult than ever to answer the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? Many graduation speeches exhort us to pursue our passions, and many a parent worry that such a pursuit will lead their child into a jobless future. Flannery Winchester, though, was not put off by the concerns of others.
I felt pretty confident that I could do something in editing or writing or something in this communicating world. And so I majored in English. And then when I graduated, I went right into a job as basically a staff writer and kind of social media person for a local magazine in Atlanta, Georgia.
In many ways, the job was a great fit, and it gave Flannery a chance to grow as a writer and communicator.
It was a small team, and I got a lot of experience in different areas of communications and also working really closely with the publisher of the magazine to understand what her goals were and how to grow and how to kind of translate her vision into the types of articles and Facebook posts and things that she wanted to see. So that was really great experience. And I actually ended up being the editor of that magazine for a while, which sounds a lot fancier than it is. I can't emphasize enough what a small team it was. So as I rose up, it's not like I climbed up a big long ladder. It was just a very small team, and they eventually gave me more responsibility. And so I ran the editorial side of the magazine.
Although Flannery experienced success on the job, something was missing for her.
I was there for 2.5 years, and I started to think to myself, I'm good at these skills, right? I have these skills of writing and editing. It wasn't lighting me up to do them about just any old topic. This was a women's sort of health and fitness magazine, and I realized I don't really care about writing about mascara or the latest, you know, fitness trend. Like, all of that is fine, but it wasn't my passion. And so I started to ask myself, how can I use these skills that I have to do something that I care really deeply about?
Her concern for environmental issues and for climate change in particular motivated her to pursue another position.
So I started applying for a bunch of jobs in the environmental and climate space. got absolutely radio silence from every application that I sent out. And I was trying to figure out why was I not getting any response? I decided that the answer probably was that I had nothing on my resume related to the climate or environment space. So people were looking at my applications and going, why is this person trying to get this job or trying to work in this organization? They're not related to this. They haven't shown any interest in this before.
What Flannery did as a result of the lack of response she received, well, it serves as a masterclass on relentlessly pursuing a passion. First step is that she decided to try another tactic, get to know the space she hopes to inhabit.
So I decided, instead of spinning my wheels and still trying to get a job in that space, that I would just go volunteer. I would just start doing the work I wanted to do, even if nobody would pay me for it yet, while I still did the paying job that I had. I did that and went to a bunch of different climate and environment stuff all around the city of Atlanta. I actually participated in planning the People's Climate March of 2015 in Atlanta, which we felt like was a great success. We had like 550 people there. This was right before the Conference of Parties in Paris, so right before the COP where they formed the Paris Agreement. So that was an exciting time to get connected with the sort of the movement and the advocacy world and to help plan that event.
In sampling different environmental and climate groups, though, Flannery realized not every one of them was a good fit for her.
And one that I remember in particular was like a support circle kind of thing where people were just sort of meeting and chatting and hanging out as advocates who care about this kind of stuff. And it was like a potluck thing. So I brought a dish and was meeting all these people for the first time. And the thing that struck me about that whole evening was that everybody was so pessimistic. And this was only like 2015. But everybody was so, so pessimistic about the possibility that we would be able to actually fix climate change or that we would be able to heal any of the harm that we've done to the earth. I could not get out of there fast enough. I was just like, this is not the attitude that I want to bring to this work or the kind of attitude that I want to be around if I'm going to do this for the long haul. Like, I need something that is more optimistic and more sure that we can make positive change.
She didn't let that one group discourage her. Then, in fall of 2015, she went to an event that would end up defining her career path.
A Facebook friend posted about an event that was a letter writing party hosted by Citizens Climate Lobby of Atlanta. This is another thing I can check out and try. Within minutes of walking in the door of that event, I had met the group leader of the Atlanta chapter and some other CCLers that were in the chapter. And then they had put a pen in my hand and sat me down and said, we're going to write to our senators about the fact that we want them to take climate change really seriously and we want them to enact policy to address it. By the end of the night, I had written out and addressed and stamped my letters to my members of Congress, and I felt so snazzy because I had never done anything like that before. It was so concrete that it was really satisfying to have done that. It was so distinct from that space where I had been, where everybody was pessimistic and just didn't think we could fix anything. It was the polar opposite of that. Everybody in that room had this sense of, if we make our voices heard, if we show up together, if we apply pressure together and we stay persistent, we can make our elected officials take this seriously and enact the kinds of solutions that we really need to see, and we can solve this problem.
Turns out this local CCL chapter was connected to the national CCL headquarters in a way that was perfect for Flannery.
Steve Valk, who was CCL's communications staffer at the time, he was in that chapter. I met not just advocates who wanted to do things with the same kind of attitude that I did, but I also met a staff member who needed some help. After he and I talked some about my professional interests and skills and what he did for CCL, we realized there was some overlap there. And so I started as a volunteer writing blog posts for the CCL blog and eventually coordinating other volunteer blog writers and having a monthly blog meeting to talk about our content and plan new content and all of that. In the end, I did end up doing what I set out to do, which was start doing climate work with the skills that I had, even if nobody was going to pay me yet. And so I kept my day job while I got plugged in as a volunteer, and then was very lucky that when CCL expanded the next time that there was additional grant money and donor funds that allowed us to expand our staff, that Steve hired me on for the communications team. And so that was in 2017. And then I've been on staff ever since.
Anyone concerned about the causes and impacts of climate change knows just how exhausting and overwhelming that work can be. But what if climate work becomes your full-time occupation?
The biggest difference that I noticed when I started working full-time on climate was that my level of anxiety about climate change went way down, which I didn't expect, and which you might not think would happen. You might think if you're focused on it all the time, that might get you more anxious. But actually, I knew I had been worried about climate change for years, but I had never really felt the permission to worry about it as much as I really did. And so it was something that was always kind of at the edges of my awareness, but I had to spend my days doing work on other stuff. I had to sort of pretend like other things were more important to do with my time than to solve this problem that felt like it was so, I mean, it is existential. When I finally got a chance to spend all my working hours on trying to address climate change, I felt so much more peaceful because I wasn't having to pretend that that anxiety wasn't there. I wasn't asking myself to look away from this big problem. But instead, I got to open up my laptop every morning at 9 a.m. and say, okay, I'm going to stare right at this thing that I'm so worried about, and I'm going to spend the next 8 hours doing everything I can to help move things in the right direction. That was a huge shift. And I still feel that to this day. Like, I feel so much peace and freedom in the ability to be able to work directly on the thing that I see as one of the biggest problems that we face.
Fortunately for Flannery, she was not working alone.
So Steve is the OG CCL staffer. He has been here since the beginning and has seen so much growth and evolution in the organization. That's a real asset because we have grown a lot over the last 4 or 5 years. And there's a whole lot of people here now on staff who have learned that history. But Steve is one of the very few who lived that history and helped create that history. And he came to CCL after a 30-year career with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He was a great person to do this media work because his whole career was in the journalism space. CCL had grown a lot and has grown a lot since then. We went from the early days having a handful of chapters out in California to eventually getting to where we have supporters in every congressional district all across the country. We have something like 450 plus chapters here in the United States. We have almost 600 worldwide. That level of change and evolution in the organization, we were also experiencing changes and evolution in the communications department.
When you work for an organization advocating for specific climate policies, how do you measure success? And how does an organization and its communications department adapt to increasing success?
Part of what was happening those same early years of like 2017, 2018, 2019 is that we went from the policy that we were advocating for was not really on the table in Congress. It was still just an idea that we were asking members of Congress to introduce as legislation. And at the end of 2018, it actually was introduced as bipartisan legislation for the first time. The game we were kind of playing had gone to a higher field I'm not sure how to say that really, but we were playing in the big leagues at that point. in a way that we never had before. Steve, because he'd been with the organization so long, was able to see that moment for what it was. Things are really different now. And the needs of this department, in order to serve the mission, the needs of this department are different now. The pace of the department is different. The focus of the department had become slightly different.
And this is when Flannery's story takes an unexpected turn. In fact, it was this marvelous twist in her story that compelled me to reach out to her. Flannery tells us what her boss, Steve Volk, did in response to these rapid changes.
He went to Mark, our executive director, and said, Flannery is the right person to sort of lead us into this next phase of what the department needs to do and how the organization is growing. I want to work for her. Mark said, okay, and they sat me down one evening at the November conference. We were all in the lobby of the Omni Shoreham Hotel, and they told me that they wanted to make this change and asked what I thought about it. And I am driven by this mission in the same way that Steve is driven by this mission. And if this was what was right to meet the moment and to keep evolving and growing CCL, I was happy to do it.
I asked her about the first thing she did after that meeting where she was offered the head of communications job.
I think I texted a friend that I had actually just met for coffee in DC and just texted her like, well, you'll never believe what just happened. Because that's not the kind of thing that happens. There's a lot of organizations where it's all about ego and you're jockeying for a better position or for more favor or for a fancier sounding title. And it's just not like that here at CCL. Like, we are all committed to political will for a livable world. And so I think it really speaks to CCL's culture and to Steve himself. He was so focused on the mission that he stepped back and saw, like, I think this will be a better move for the organization and for the goals that we're trying to achieve. Yeah, it was just an incredible moment.
Flannery Winchester patiently pursued her passion. When she needed more experience, she found it as a volunteer. She remained steady and hardworking, and her passion kept her focused. Then doors opened for her. This is the sort of persistence and determination needed in this extraordinary time of climate change.
When something's really important to me, I will figure out how to grow in the ways I need to grow in order to do the thing that's important. So, like, if you had told me 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that I would be moderating a panel discussion with climate experts in front of a room of 2,000 people, I would have been scared, and I probably would have laughed and said, no way, I wouldn't do that. And so I think what I've learned is that I'm willing to do the hard stuff and push a little bit outside of my comfort zone and expand that comfort zone when there's a really good reason to. And the really good reason is I really want to solve climate change.
You can experience Flannery's communications efforts by visiting the blog at citizensclimatelobby.org. You can even sign up for the monthly newsletter. Now it is time for the Art House and another installment of the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club. Every month, Krista Heiser looks at climate-themed literature. She thinks out loud about how climate fiction can help us engage with the real-world challenges we face today. An avid reader, whenever Krista suggests I read a book, I've never been disappointed.
This month, in the Ultimate Cli-Fi Book Club, we discuss Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, an award-winning novel just released as an HBO miniseries. I call it climate fiction because pandemic is an impact of increasing temperatures, mass migrations, and the incursion of human habitat into natural ecosystems. Back in April of 2020, novelist Arundhati Roy nailed it when she said the pandemic is a portal. She called COVID-19 the wreckage of a train that has been careening down the track for years. Now that comment, along with my friend Kristen Flintz's amazing poem, An Imagined Letter from COVID-19 to Humans, these define for me the literary starting point for sense-making about COVID-19. Station 11 was published years before the first cases of coronavirus. It features a quick and brutal Georgia flu, which eliminates 99% of the human population in just weeks. The novel captures the onset of apocalypse perfectly. An early character, Jeevan, has just given CPR, unsuccessfully, to a famous actor who dies of a heart attack on stage while playing King Lear. The individual death presages the collective death of Western civilization, along with air conditioning, airplanes, television, punk rock, and oranges. Jeevan gets an early heads up from a friend who works in a hospital. His friend is pretty much already dead as he passes on the warning. It's a few minutes before midnight as Jeevan fills shopping carts with supplies, water, toilet paper, aspirin, garbage bags, bleach, duct tape, and also coffee, crackers, salt, preserved cakes, and a bouquet of daffodils. He does this on autopilot, almost like he can't believe what he's doing, and I love this line in the book. Jeevan was crushed by a sudden certainty that this was it, that this illness was going to be the divide between a before and an after, a line drawn through his life. So just like that, we step through a portal into the after of the rest of the novel. There's no vaccine, no mandates, no conspiracy, but there are survivors. The young female protagonist, Kirsten, wanders around the Great Lakes region. She bands together with other actors and musicians as a traveling symphony. Climate change makes a cameo at the start of Chapter 7. 20 years after the end of air travel, the caravans of the traveling symphony moved slowly under a white-hot sky. It was the end of July, and the 25-year-old thermometer affixed to the back of the lead caravan read 106 Fahrenheit, 41 Celsius. I guess that after everybody was dead, there was nobody to hold governments to the 1.5-degree promise of the Paris Agreement. In an interview with Elle magazine, the author said, "When I was researching and writing Station 11, what I found myself thinking about all the time is how fragile civilization is and how we should never take it for granted. It just doesn't take much for things to fall apart." The main character, Kirsten, has this tattoo on her arm that says, "Survival is insufficient." It seems at first to be a call for the humanities, like human life after this bottleneck might not have cars or air conditioning, but there might be Shakespeare and violins and kindness. I love this scene about the tattoo, where Kirsten creates an imaginary memory of the Star Trek episode where the quote originated. She wasn't sure if she actually remembered anything at all of Star Trek. She allowed herself to imagine that she remembered it. A television in a living room, a ship moving through the night silence of space, her brother watching beside her, their parents, if she could only remember their faces, somewhere near. So I pulled up the Star Trek Voyager episode, which brought back memories of how creepy and scary the Borg was back in the day. Seven of Nine is the character who delivers the line, "Survival is insufficient." But she's not talking about cultural grace notes in deep space. She's talking about freedom of thought. You see, Seven of Nine had been assimilated into the Borg as a child. Just like Kirsten, she would not have remembered her life before. But later, after she was liberated from the Borg, she made a decision to save three of her crewmates by inserting nanoprobes into their left cerebral hemispheres to relink them to the Borg collective. Without that neuralink, they would die. With it, they could survive, but as Borg drones. Seven of Nine decides to free them, which actually means to kill them, from the collective because, as she says, survival is insufficient. It leads me to ponder the implications of eco-fascism and survivalist cults. That type of survival, for Kirsten, was insufficient. I get it. But what does it mean to be an individual versus a collective when it comes to our planetary predicament? The separation of me from you and you from them and us from nature and all other living beings, isn't the great collective of Gaia what we actually need to be part of? Isn't our individuality, our specialness, what got us into this mess? Today I think of bees. They're drones. Or ants. They're a collective. If humans could be part of the noosphere that, like the Borg mind, actually makes us one, wouldn't that survival be sufficient? Climate collapse as an individual, or survival as member of a planetary Earth collective, which would you choose?
If you have an idea for the Art House, or perhaps a book suggestion for Krista, feel free to contact us, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Now it is time for our good news report.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Every day, diesel trucks chug along highways between ports, warehouses, factories, and retailers, spewing tailpipe exhaust as they go. Breathing these fumes is dangerous. Truck exhaust contains pollutants that have been associated with asthma, lung disease, heart problems, and cancer. Reagan Patterson is a Transportation Equity Research Fellow at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. She says minority communities often bear the worst of the pollution from diesel trucks.
This really has to do with discriminatory planning processes in which communities of color and low-income communities are often located near ports, major roadways, and distribution centers, and so therefore are disproportionately exposed to diesel exhaust.
Transitioning to electric trucks could help, because electric trucks do not emit harmful tailpipe pollution. So Patterson says heavy-duty vehicles should be top of mind for policymakers as they plan investments in clean transportation.
Really saying, how do we prioritize communities that are disproportionately exposed to diesel trucks?
So that the transportation of the future can help alleviate some of the inequities of the past.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communications. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org. Thank you for joining me for episode 68 of Citizens Climate Radio. If you like what you hear and you want to support the work we do, visit citizensclimateeducation.org. There you will learn how you can make a tax-deductible contribution. Here at Citizens Climate Education, we have a solution that will greatly reduce pollution, which leads to climate change. We believe putting a price on carbon will make a huge difference. We want to tell you more about it. Visit CCLUSA.org. That's CCLUSA.org. Citizens Climate Radio is written and produced by me, Peter Santoscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Montrano, Flannery Winchester, Katie Sarkreski, and Steve Ball. Moral support from Madeline Pera. The music on today's show comes from epidemicsound.com. I invite you to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends and colleagues. You can find Citizens Climate Radio wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org and join the discussion at our Facebook group page. Just look for Citizens Climate Radio. You can also follow us on Twitter at Citizens C Radio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, at Citizens C Radio. Feel free to tweet at me directly at P2Sun, the letter P, the number 2, S-O-N. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog, and there you will see show notes and find links to our guest. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.